We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
And good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. We're glad to have you with us. This is a listener-supported radio station. That means, if I have to really spell it out, that means that people who listen call in, they go online, and they help to pay for part of the cost of putting the shows on the air. That's what it is. So we're talking about a financial contribution when we're talking about listener support. Now, occasionally here throughout the year, we sit here in front of the microphones and try to remind you of the importance of that support. And we're doing that right now, and it's a mini drive. It's only 3 days. We're trying to keep it as short as possible, and this is the last time here on Focus for a while that we'll be talking about this. But what we want to do is try to encourage at least 250 people to give us a call and make a contribution. And the number to call is 217-244-9455. And when you do that, in addition to supporting WILL, there's another benefit. The Common Ground Food Co-op will donate the cost of 3 meals to the Eastern Illinois Food Bank for every pledge that we receive. This is a kind of partnership that we have worked out with the folks at both the food bank and at Common Ground so that we can not only encourage you to support WILL, but to make some progress, we hope, some impact on another important issue in the community. So that's what's happening when you make your pledge. You're helping us, you're helping them, and it's really important. The money that's contributed by listeners, it's as every day goes by, it's a bigger share of the cost of running the station. So if you are a supporter, we want to say thanks. And if not, if you listen to Focus 580 or Morning Edition or Afternoon Magazine or All Things Considered or whatever your favorite programs are, we hope that you will support him with your dollars in a direct way. So again, you can do that by calling us at 217-244-9455, or you can go online, and that's willpledge.org, and make your contribution that way, and we thank you very much. Well, again, this is Focus 580. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also happy to have here back on the program once again Bob Parr. He's professor of political science here at the University of Illinois. He's director of the European Union Center here at the U of I. And one major interest of his, European politics. That should be obvious. But he's also very interested in the subject of national parks here in the United States, and something of their history, how it is they got established, some of the political issues that are involved. I think it's in a way, it's a personal interest of his because he really likes to be outside. But it's something that he's also turned into an academic interest and does teach courses on. And we thought it would be nice to have him back. We had him here on the program back in the fall at the time that the Ken Burns documentary on the national parks was just premiering. And the program is back now. We are showing it, and a lot of other public television stations are showing it now once a week, one show a week. The first one aired on this Wednesday, and then for the Wednesdays to come, the 3rd, the 10th, 17th, the 24th, and the last one would be March 3rd, 8 o'clock in the evening on Wednesdays, you can see it. So maybe you didn't see it first time around, or you'd like to see it again. It's there. And in fact, I think it will air also some other times as well. So you can go to our web page, the television web page, and check the schedule and find out. We thought it would be a good opportunity to talk a little bit more about national parks and to ask Bob to come back and do that. So that's why we're here in this hour. The number, if you'd like to call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and we also have email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Hey, thanks very much.
Well, thank you for having me back.
No, I think there are a lot of interesting things here, and I guess to me, I think one of the really interesting things to look at over time is how people have changed in the way they think of what the park is supposed to be about. And as I see it, and I know this is something that you've written about, there was this big change from the idea that this was an exploitable resource and needs, you know, some people would have said development. So going from the point where people said, oh, this is a great resource, need to develop it, to the point where people said, wait a minute, this is a great resource, but what it needs is protection. And I think that you know, that just looking at the history of that change, I'm sure, is very interesting.
No, that's true. And that's most evident in the California parks. The first park, depending on how you define it, was Yosemite. And Yosemite, when it was given to the state of California, they just protected Yosemite Valley, the floor of the valley, which is just 4 miles long, and then one grove of the giant sequoia trees. So there was sort of one strip and one dot in what's now the national park. And that's because they thought in terms of everything else being exploitable natural resources. There was timber that presumably could be harvested. There was high elevation land that you could have sheep grazing on. There were watersheds that and rivers that could be dammed for hydroelectric power. And that remained the way people thought about the national parks, certainly into the teens. And that was very live. Well, it still remains live in different ways. But in 1968, when we got Redwoods National Park, one of the concerns was redwoods are valuable trees. Mm-hmm. How many redwoods do you need to preserve in order that people can see these 390-foot tall trees? Governor Ronald Reagan at that time famously said, "Well, if you've seen one redwood, why do you you've seen them all, right?" And that's an exaggerated notion of the concern, which is, well, how many redwoods do you really need to preserve in order to make sure that people can see what a stand of redwoods looks like?
Yeah. Well, then there also, I think, is another kind of tension that's interesting. And we're probably starting to see more and more, and that is again, it has to do, I think, with this back and forth between use and preservation. But I think in the use now that I think people are concerned about, it's not so much an industrial exploitation of the parks, but the burden on the parks and in the park environment by the number of people who want to go there. So again, there's this big question as well, do you really want to make it open and make it so that as many people can go and see there and enjoy it, but how do you mitigate the damage of all the cars and all the people and the refuse that they leave and just, you know, the big footprint of all the visitors?
Yeah, and that varies by park, of course. The least visited park in the entire system is in Alaska and gets 43 visitors a year. so there's not a big impact problem in that particular park in the Brooks Range. But the most visited park that people think of as a park is the Great Smoky Mountains. They had 9.5 million visitors last year. And that's within a day's drive here. It's about 500 miles from Champaign, so I'm sure a lot of listeners have seen it. There's a road that goes right through the middle, through the heart of the wilderness, and so it breaks the wilderness into pieces, two pieces. And then there's also roads that go around it and go in a couple of miles. And one of the questions the Park Service faces is, you know, do you want to have roads that go into the heart of the wilderness so people can see what an old-growth forest looks like or what the crest of the Smokies look like, you know, the highest peaks in the eastern United States? Or should we have roads just on the outside that go in a little bit and force people to take horses or hike in? Smokies have a huge horse industry around them. And that's always going to be a tension. And some things clearly get damaged from the tourism industry. If you think of Old Faithful and Yellowstone, the developments there predate the park, sort of. And if you think back to, say, the famous the Old Faithful Lodge, it is sitting right on top of the geyser basin, right next to Old Faithful. If we were doing that today, we'd move it back a couple hundred yards, a quarter mile, or some distance away so that you don't have a parking lot that's at risk of becoming a hot spring, which does happen in Yellowstone, that the weight of the buildings don't damage the plumbing underground and so forth. So, you know, that we would clearly do differently if we were doing it today. And the roads are an ongoing – there isn't a consensus in the United States. A lot of people who visit parks are families with young kids, you know, who are not going to hike in 12 miles, or they're senior citizens who are – I've seen senior citizens on top of mountains, so I'm not going to generalize, but many of them are not in a position to hike 12 miles in the backcountry and camp, set up camp too. So, yeah.
Well, we're coming up to – we're just a few years away from a very important anniversary as far as the parks are concerned. That's the year 2016, and I think that a lot of people are looking ahead to that and also saying there are some important issues here that have to do with the future of the parks that we ought to be talking about. And some people are trying to at least have some input into this conversation. As far as the parks are concerned, and people who are thinking about that in Washington or elsewhere, what really are the big issues?
One of the issues from the standpoint of the environment would be almost every park is too small to protect the habitats that or the wildlife that are in the parks. So even a big park like Yellowstone, mm-hmm. the bison, large numbers of the bison migrate out into lower elevation country to the west. The elk migrate out to lower elevation in the north. The pronghorn antelope migrate out. It's a summer home for white pelicans that spend their winters in Arizona and elsewhere. So they're migratory species, and it's obviously not big enough to protect a migratory species. So the habitat is connected with the outside world, and depending on the park, that's a big problem or a little problem. Yellowstone has big animals, and big animals tend to need more space.
And that the land around there, is, I assume that it is privately owned?
It varies. There's a number of national forests. So those are different than national parks. They were originally set aside to make sure that we didn't run out of timber. And they've historically been used for timber and for other extractive resources. So there's mining, there's livestock grazing. The bison, when they wander out, come into conflict with the grazing because the bison of Yellowstone carry a disease called brucellosis that can be transmitted to cattle. Mm-hmm. And so the cattle and the bison use the lands at different times of the year, but if you were a rancher, you'd still be concerned about how that might get transmitted or whether it can be transmitted by aborted fetuses and so forth. So there's definite conflicts there. There's also some other kinds of lands, wildlife refuges and Bureau of Land Management lands in the area that have different philosophies of use, but there's different ways in which it conflicts with people.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and if one said it would be a good idea to try to enlarge some of these parks, would part of that have to be that you would actually have to purchase land that's privately held, or is it just a matter of repurposing land that may be federally held but under some different sort of terms?
In the West, there's usually adjacent federal lands that could be repurposed. So Yellowstone's surrounded by 6 national forests, and you could repurpose those. You could enlarge Yellowstone, which doesn't happen. What does happen is the Forest Service has changed in how it manages its lands, and there are some lands that the Forest Service has set aside from timber in wilderness areas, or Congress has actually set them aside. And so you could change the way you manage those to make the park bigger. In the East, you have to buy the land up. So if you think of Mammoth Cave in Kentucky, the cave depends on rainwater dripping through the limestone, which then erodes the cave and creates the stalactites and the stalagmites and other formations. So if you want to preserve the cave, you have to preserve the land on top. We're continually learning that the cave is bigger than we thought. That means you need more land on top, and that's privately held land, so you'd have to buy it up.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Bob Parr. He's professor of political science at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. He's director of the European Union Center. And in addition to being interested in European politics, he's also interested in some of the political issues surrounding the national parks and their history. And questions are welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And we do also have that email if you'd like to send us your question that way. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have here a caller on our toll-free line. This is line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. Yeah, I'm a product. I'm a retired Forest Service personnel. I used to work up in that wood. That was where I'm from, actually, is up in the northwest or the center part of the California, up by Yosemite. And you're describing verbatim everything that's happened out there. The problem is it's with the government, with that end, with the Park Service and the Forest Service, they're at the bottom end of the totem pole when it comes to the budget. So I can tell you this, it's very, we don't get paid a lot of money. I did that. I started out in high school, and I started out when I graduated in the mid-70s, and I did that all the way up until I moved out here in 88, and I still did it for a few years afterwards because I was on a fire crew, but I spent a lot of time up there, and I got to know a lot of the areas in the Southwest and the West. And the problem is people just trash the heck out of it. It's amazing what people can do to damage things. They don't stay on trails. I used to put up barriers on one weekend, and then the next weekend they're gone because you got people with off-road vehicles and motorcycles going. And from what I understand, just recently they're talking about closing down Yosemite just for the fact of the compaction in the trees. People don't understand how delicate the ecosystem is up there. And I spent, I used to spend weeks in the backcountry backpacking back in there doing it as a backpack ranger. It's amazing. Broken bottles, glass, and this might be 25, 30 miles away from any, on a foot trail, any town. And it's insane. I mean, the part of the problem is the Forest Service and the Park Service don't get their just rewards when it comes to getting the funding and the regeneration needs of those trees. I mean, I used to see people come out of there with axes, basically cutting down during Christmas time, cutting down redwood trees for Christmas trees. I mean, it's insane. But see, here in the Midwest, there isn't any forest out here. The closest one is Shawnee National Forest. So that, people don't care. They think it's like a good Sam, park or a Circle K park or something. So with amusement rides, they have to have a McDonald's or a Starbucks. It's just there is no back to nature anymore. I don't know if you feel that way about it. I mean, one of the reasons why I don't work there anymore is because they weren't paying with a darn. And I got friends of mine that are still there that are firefighters. And I tell you what, you got to like that job because you don't make any money whatsoever. So, thanks. I'm glad you're having this on because it's true to my heart. I'm an environmentalist. And it's sickening to see what's going on out there. Thanks.
Right. Well, I think that, that's one of the things about the documentary series and the people that profiled it in there. It seems like people who are just doing it for the love of it. And I don't know that you can really, today, you can expect somebody to be a park ranger just because they love being outdoors. You just can't do that.
Yeah, I don't know what the pay scale is like now in the Forest Service. The Park Service actually managed to improve their pay scale some in the 1990s. So they used to be paid very poorly. They're paid a little better than they used to be. The main challenge that they face on the personnel side is it's really hard to have a two career couple or to raise a family. You get transferred from one remote location to another remote location, and they're beautiful remote locations. But if you have a family and you were stationed in Big Bend National Park, the staff housing is at Panther Junction. The nearest high school is at Alpine, Texas, which is a two-hour bus ride one way each day. It's the longest bus ride in the lower 48 states. So if your kids go to high school, that's 4 hours on the bus every day in order for you to be able to pursue your career. And that means if you have a two-career couple, either you're both in the Park Service and you have to hope you end up at the station in the same place, or the spouse that doesn't work in the Park Service has to commute probably 2 hours to Alpine also. They might be able to get a job in Study Butte, only 45 minutes away.
We are just about at the midpoint of this part of Focus 580, and we're talking a little bit about some of the issues involved with the national parks and something of their history. And in part, the reason we're doing that is just to remind people once again that the Ken Burns documentary series on the national parks is running again. Bob was here on the program back in the fall when the program premiered for the first time. Since the program was back, we thought, well, maybe we'd ask him to come back and spend a little bit more time talking. Questions are certainly welcome here on the program. We got 333-9455. That is our local number, the number here for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And then we do have the possibility of email. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. And we are also trying to encourage people to call in and make contributions to the radio station. We are taking just a couple of days here. We want to get back to our regular programming just as quick as we possibly can, but it's also something that we really need to do to remind listeners that your financial support is essential. We couldn't do it without the support of listeners and for in the case of public television, without the support of viewers. And it's something that, you know, periodically we feel we have to sit here and remind people of that, particularly people who are not supporters. We have some folks that are very generous and very loyal and have supported us for a long time. And every time we do this, I really want to try to make a point of saying thanks to those people. That's really important. And if for whatever reason you have not supported the station in the past, this is a great time to do it. And we're only going to be here on Focus 580 just this morning. And then next week we'll be back on our regular schedule. We'll be spending a little time tomorrow asking for support. But that's it. We want to really try to keep this short. So for this to work, for this really short drive to work, we need to get it the support of as many people as possible. So that's why we're asking for people to call. We're asking people to go online and make a pledge. Martha Deal is one of our producers, one of those people that I couldn't do without here on Focus 580. And she's also here to help, make the argument that this is a station worth supporting.
It is indeed a station worth supporting. We try and bring you programming that answers the questions that come up when you hear news pieces or just things you've been wondering about in the world. David, I have some really exciting news to share about how the community has stepped up to our response. As of 10 o'clock this morning, we heard from more than 125 contributing listeners. And the goal is to hear from over 250 through the course of the day. We're halfway through, and we want to thank you all for contributing in the way that you have. When you call and make a contribution, the Common Ground Food Bank is going to provide three meals through the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. And you helping us actually gives a benefit to the community in more than one way. So thank you very much.
Yeah, okay. Well, again, you can do this a couple of ways. You can call, and the number to pledge is 217-244-9455. Or if you'd like, you can do it online, and I think more and more people are choosing to do it that way. So we have an online site. It's willpledge.org, and you can do it that way. And the amount, that's up to you. But we hope that you will actually make the decision to be a supporter. And it's really great we have this relationship here going with the folks at the food bank and the food co-op. So again, the folks at the Common Ground Food Co-op, they will donate the cost of three meals to the Eastern Illinois Food Bank for every pledge that we receive. So we think that's a good thing. We hope that you will too, and that you will help us out. And again, this morning our guest is Robert Parr, Bob Parr. He's a professor of political science here at the U of I, director of the European Union Center. And we are spending some time talking here with him about one of his interests, academic and personal, and that's the history of the national parks. And part of the reason, as I said, that we're doing it right now is just to remind people that the Ken Burns documentary series on the parks is airing once again. It will air one every week here on WILL television. On Wednesday nights, the first one was Wednesday of this week, and then every week for the next several weeks, they will air on Wednesday nights and also some other times too. So if you want, you go to our website, check the television schedule, and you can find when the program is airing. We have another caller here, someone to talk with, and this person is in Mahomet on our line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've seen the Ken Burns series, and I really enjoyed it, but you know, and the parks are always wanting to get more money. Why don't they send some professional person out there to make beautiful films of the park for people like me who are never going to make it there? I did go to Rocky Mountain Park, and I'll never go again because I couldn't take the heights. So I spent most of my time with a jacket over my head while my husband was driving. But anyway, I would love to see these various parks, but I'm just not a traveler, and I would be quite willing to buy a DVD that isn't trying to get me to come to the park, you know, and just showing me the hotels and stuff. I want to see the nature that I won't be able to see. And thank you. I'll listen off air.
Okay.
Well, that you actually raised one of the issues that I was a little disappointed in with the Burns film. Ken Burns is famous for having historical photographs and panning the camera over them and panning them in and panning them out. And, of course, he did that in the National Park series, too. So we saw a lot of historical photographs. But they're so beautiful. Why not go out and take more live footage? He took a lot of live footage, but he could have taken more live footage and done a little bit less of the historical photographs. There are other filmmakers that make use of the parks. The big parks are important wildlife refuges. And so wildlife photographers might not say that they're showing the national parks, but if you see a documentary on wolves or a documentary on bison, they're probably using Yellowstone, maybe Wind Cave National Park in South Dakota for the bison. So you might see them but not see them sold that way. The other thing is, I know the big spectacular parks tend to be out west. The closest national park that has the name National Park in its title is Mammoth Cave, which is not too far. That's about 300 miles from us. But there's 392 units in the national park system. That includes the Lincoln sites in Springfield, which we don't think of as national parks, but they're historic sites run by the National Park Service. And there's also a lot of other kinds of units like National Lakeshores and National Seashores, and our closest one here is Indiana Dunes. So if elevation is hard for you at Rocky Mountain, or if you don't want to travel more than 1,000 miles to the Rocky Mountains, we do have Indiana Dunes, which is doable as a long day trip or an easy overnight. There's a lot of places to stay. Indiana Dunes is a really special place. It actually has more plant species than all but two other units of the national park system, Grand Canyon and Smoky Mountains. So if you like plants, it's an extraordinary resource. And, of course, the dunes are beautiful, too. Mm. You can make it in a, it's as easy as getting up to Chicago. And so I'd encourage people to go out and think of that as a national park.
Yeah. And I think that's it's a good point to make, that I think often people don't appreciate the opportunities they have to get out and be up close and personal with nature that are close to home. Maybe they think about the places that get so much attention, like Yellowstone and mm-hmm. Glacier and Yosemite, you know, places like that, and they're very beautiful and they're very dramatic and they're well worth seeing. Mm-hmm. But that's a long way away and it's a major undertaking, and I'm sure that there are people that say, well, you know, if I knew places that I could go that were close to where I am, I would really think about that, but I'm not sure that people really know about those places, or maybe they just don't get the kind of promotion that really they deserve.
No, they don't. And national parks are not the only kind of preserved land we have. A previous caller mentioned Shawnee National Forest, which is in Illinois, and 3 or 4 hours away, depending on where you're going there. There are also national wildlife refuges, and Illinois is relatively well endowed with those. There's a lot of wildlife refuges along the Illinois River and along the Mississippi River, preserving flyways in particular for migratory birds and preserving other river habitats. Wisconsin has a lot of national forests, quite a few wildlife refuges. Iowa has a wonderful wildlife refuge just outside Des Moines, which is the Neil Smith Refuge, which is being rebuilt or reconstructed, rehabilitated for prairie, tall grass prairie wildlife. And so they have a bison herd, for example. They have beautiful tall grass species. So within a reasonable car ride of Champaign, Urbana, and other places in Illinois, you can see these resources that don't get quite as much publicity but are also special places in their own way.
Mm. We talked just a little bit earlier. I mentioned the fact that there's an important anniversary coming up, the year being 2016, and a lot of people are using that as an opportunity to say, well, we really ought to be taking stock. We ought to be talking about the parks. We ought to be thinking about them, what they need, how best to preserve and manage them. And I think that actually an effort started during the time that George Bush was still the president to raise some of those issues. And I'm not exactly sure how people feel about the approach that the Bush administration took. Yeah. What about that?
Well, there's a little story there. You see the first half of the story in the Ken Burns film. I think it's the fourth, maybe the fifth episode, when he talks about the 50th anniversary of the Park Service. And the Park Service had a 10-year project called Mission 66 for 1966, the 50th mm-hmm. anniversary. And the Park Service had seen a gigantic increase in visitation after World War II. So the GIs came back, they set up, started their families, they got jobs, they bought cars, and they wanted to see the national parks. And the parks couldn't handle the traffic. And Mission 66 built roads, campgrounds, visitor centers, sewage facilities, water systems, I mean, all the back hidden infrastructure in the parks. And it was a gigantic construction project. Something to serve the visitors was clearly necessary, but the Park Service was also criticized for going too far and building too much inside mm-hmm. the parks mm-hmm. instead of trying to build outside as well. The Centennial Initiative is what the Park Service calls the next one for 2016. And that was started in the latter years of the Bush administration. And the language talks more about nature and ecosystems. When you look at the report and the plans, it goes back to building. So it might not be building roads, but they're rehabilitating roads that need maintenance. Or there might not be building new visitor centers, but they're rehabilitating visitor centers or adding annexes. So a lot of the resources are still going into construction. Although if you just looked at the website, the resources sounded as if it was going into staff, but it's not actually going into staff. Those salaries will stay low. Interestingly, that the website for that project came down about halfway into Obama's first year.
Really?
And I've put out some questions to contacts in the Park Service, and nobody's been able to provide any information either secretly or openly about who took it down, why they took it down. But people have the same sort of suspicions that I have, which is the Obama administration probably wants to de-emphasize construction and probably wants to emphasize staff instead of things. But we'll see if and when they put up a new website, if that's actually what's going on.
Yeah. What for those members of Congress who represent those areas, what do they want? And if you ask them what's of those sort of those two approaches, what is they would like to see the money go into? What do they say?
Members of Congress love building things. They love building things
there,
and they love naming it after one another, right? And that certainly happens in the national parks. When it happens in the transportation bill, we call it a pork barrel project. In the National Park Service, we call it a park barrel project. And it's clear that members of Congress have a weakness for that. The staff of the National Park Service, these are people that get reassigned every 2 to 5 years. So they're not your local constituents. They don't have, you don't have a relationship with them. They're not long-term supporters or voters for you. Mm-hmm. So those folks are not so attractive to members of Congress of either party. And that really doesn't matter whether you're a Democrat or Republican. You like construction, yeah. And the construction is local jobs. And the Park Service staff is temporarily local but not so interesting politically.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with someone else here who is listening in Belgium on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all.
Good morning.
Like one of your previous callers, I am an avid fan of the national parks. But as you pointed out, there are areas much, much, much closer that don't get the visitation that should. I'm located over here on the east side of the state, as you all know. Along the Wabash River, there are several nice park areas that people don't visit at all. Portland Arch being one just north of Covington and Fountain has eagle population to some extent along the Wabash River. Fabulous walk that this time of year, the moss and lichens there are like you've never seen. They can be 2 inches tall. That doesn't sound very big, but for moss and lichens, that's pretty big. And it's the most beautiful green you'll ever see because everything else is so white and brown. Also, if you go, you've all probably heard of Turkey Run and Shades State Park over in Indiana, but between the two of them, there's a place called, I think it's called Pine Ridge. Just a beautiful walk that goes through. When this previous caller said there's not woods in the Midwest, there are. There's beautiful woods there. Now, it's not the kind of woods that he's used to in the West, where it goes on for millions of square miles, but it's a beautiful woods for what it is. And it's just, we're not here in Illinois and Indiana. It's not woods here. You've got to think more in tall grass, as you mentioned before. There are some very nice places called Chautauqua over along the Illinois River that's just another fabulous place to go to. So you don't have to go near as far as most people think. And thank you very much. Good day.
All right. Well,
thank you. Well, it's interesting. The state parks are actually tied politically to the Park Service, National Park Service. Originally, locals didn't like national parks because it meant taking timber or rangeland or mining out of production. But when we started to get automobiles in the 19-teens and the 1920s, all of a sudden the tourism industry became a mass industry and generated a lot of money. And local congressmen started to say, hey, we've got a wonderful thing here that should be a national park, and maybe we could attract some tourism. So the Park Service was inundated with hundreds of proposals for national parks. And what they decided to do was start training state parks agencies, or helping states create state parks agencies, and then shunting off these proposals into state parks as second-class parks because the Park Service didn't think they were first-class. But they're still wonderful regional resources. So the Park Service tried to sort which of these are nationally important, which of them are regionally important, and the caller's examples were great examples of regionally important things around here. The prairie is a hard sell. We don't have a prairie national park. We have some things that are could be classified as sort of prairie national parks. There's a Tallgrass Prairie Park and Preserve in Kansas and Badlands and Theodore Roosevelt in the Dakotas. And we have important resources. We are a global hotspot for freshwater mussels, many of which are endangered. Freshwater mussels are a hard sell. People don't get very excited about freshwater mussels or moss and lichen, as the caller pointed out. So there's room for some real preservationist parks around here, but that involves selling freshwater mussels and lichen and things like that.
Just not as exciting as buffalo and geysers.
Right, but also important. And a good if your watershed is falling apart, the mussels will be the first things to die off. So they're good canaries in the coal mine.
So what is the budget of the National Park Service?
That's an excellent question, and I don't know it off the top of my head. The parks that don't get huge number of visitors will have operating budgets of millions of dollars. The ones that have big ones like Yellowstone or Yosemite will have budgets of hundreds of millions of dollars. And all of the parks rely a lot on viewer support, like WILL. They all have an association, like the Yellowstone Association or Isle Royale Natural History Association in Lake Superior. And they funnel a lot of donations from people that love the parks into things that the Park Service needs done but Congress won't fund. And so those volunteer-supported organizations provide a lot of money. In cases of Yosemite, more money than the Park Service than Congress provides. Mm. And they also provide a lot of volunteers, and it's a popular thing for students or for retirees to go volunteer for a week or two or a summer in a park.
Yeah. Here, now this is something I guess I should know. What there is for the parks in the way of user fees? Do you, for example, again, I suppose this is something I should know, as you roll up to the gate, you want to go into Yellowstone. Do you have to pay money to get in?
Yes, you do.
You do have to pay.
Now, the median visitor in a park doesn't stay very long. So the median visitor in Yellowstone actually only stays 90 minutes.
They just roll into the Old Faithful and then they
roll
and then they
on
roll out.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Now, that's the median. So that's a tour bus visitor. But the minimum entrance is a week-long pass, which costs $20. Now, Disney World costs $65 or $70 a day. So $20 is a bargain to see something like Yellowstone. You can also get an annual pass for all of the parks, in fact, all the federal lands in the United States. That's $80 for a family, unless you're a retiree or disabled, in which case you can get it, I believe, just for $10 or might be free for disabled.
Which I'm sure that if you really had the opportunity to get a lot of use, would be a terrific bargain. That's such a tiny amount of money.
Right.
And relatively.
And a lot of parks are free. Great Smoky Mountain is free by statute, for example, because the road up the middle was used by truckers when it was made a park, and North Carolina and Tennessee insisted that that road be free.
Yeah. Other questions here? We have a little bit of time, maybe about 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Bob Parr. He's professor of political science at the U of I. He's director of the European Union Center. And this particular subject here we're talking about is also one that's an academic interest of his, and he teaches on that is environmental politics and policy that involve, touch on the national parks. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and also email will-talk@illinois.edu. I think we have a caller who just wanted to make the point that there are these opportunities for people, young people particularly, to do volunteer work in parks. Is there some way, how would you find out what opportunities there were if you wanted to do something like that?
You could go through an individual park and try to find the association. There's also, for students, a student conservation association that puts together work crews in parks. Kids who are young and strong and would like to be outdoors, the parks need you to work on trails. Right. So if you imagine what happens over the winter, trees fall down, trails get washed away, they need rebuilding, they've eroded or whatever else. a lot of it requires strong backs. So all those boys and girls who would like to go outside and feel healthy for a summer, that's a great opportunity. I think you can volunteer as young as 16, and when you're a little older, you can work for a small salary too. So.
Did much CCC work go into national parks?
CCC was gigantic in the national parks. So.
Civilian Conservation Corps, which was one of the New Deal projects that Franklin Roosevelt and his administration came up with as a way to try to provide some employment for young, I'm sure pretty much it was young men, and give them something constructive to do, and then also provide a little bit of money, which I think most of that money had to actually go back to their families.
Right.
So it gave them a job, gave them something to do, something good, constructive, put food in their mouths, and then also a little bit of money, which I'm sure was very important, then went back to their families. It sounded like one of those things when people look back at it, it was one of the best things maybe the federal government ever did.
Yeah, and it did a lot of the initial development of national parks, or in some cases, they worked in state parks also, national forests, or lands that were being targeted for national parks. So they were in the big famous parks. We haven't talked about Big Bend yet, but in Big Bend, the Civilian Conservation Corps actually moved in before it became a national park, put in the road to the core of the park at Chisos Basin, put in the campgrounds, put in lodges, built the trail network, which hadn't previously existed. And that's true everywhere, really, the Civilian Conservation Corps. Most of the trails you see were built by them or improved by them throughout the national park system, the campgrounds and everything else. If you know where to look, you can also find their camps. They either lived in tents or tents on platforms, sort of quasi-permanent tents, or sometimes they lived in simple frame buildings. And it's a measure of what human impact looks like, that if you know where those camps are, you can still see the impact is quite evident that there used to be something big there with a lot of people walking around trampling, even though it's 70 years since that it was taken out.
We are coming down to about our last 5 minutes or so. We have another caller here as well. We'll get them in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I'm rather curious. I wonder if Professor Parr has any idea of what percentage of the total land mass of the lower 48 states is devoted to national parks.
The total share of the lower 48 that's federal land is well over 20%. And how much of that is national parks, I'm not sure, but I would guess about a quarter of that, 20-odd percent. So be a relatively high single-digit number. The share in Alaska is much, much higher. And so that raises the average for the country as a whole. Alaska has some huge parks.
One kind of a follow-up question. How many people are employed by the National Park Service?
Well, that's a good Trivia Pursuit question, and I really don't have any idea how to answer that. A lot of the people that work for the Park Service are seasonal. It's despite the low pay, it's a popular job for young people, and it's extremely competitive to get in. And normally you have to work for several seasons and then show that you're good stuff, and then they'll hire you as a permanent employee. But a lot of them are seasonal. And there's also a lot of people that work for the businesses in the park. Those are concessioners, privately owned businesses on a license from the parks. And if you go to a park, you'll see college students, Eastern Europeans who are here working on their English for the summer, and other part-time help, flipping burgers and making up rooms and that sort of basic labor that you have to have done in the parks.
Interesting.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, indeed.
As I've said here a couple of times, part of the reason for doing this was just to remind people that the series, the Ken Burns series, mm-hmm. is going to run again and has started. This week was the first one, and then every Wednesday now for the next several weeks. And it's certainly not our purpose to sit here and talk about things that he didn't, he maybe should have done, but he didn't. But I am interested in because it's something that you've thought a lot about and that you have seen these programs, whether you thought that there were some things, maybe some parts of the story that didn't get the kind of attention that they really should have.
Yeah, my biggest thing that I noticed about those 12 hours is that about half of the total screen time is Yellowstone and Yosemite. So there's two national parks out of the 58 that are getting the majority of the screen time. And the 392 units got very little screen time. And it meant that a lot of parks that are very interesting in different ways received only a token mention. So Isle Royale National Park, which is an island archipelago really in the middle of Lake Superior, it's almost entirely a wilderness area, received about 5 seconds of screen time. He mentioned that it existed. Mm-hmm. Big Bend, which is a huge park in southern Texas along the Mexican border, received another 5 seconds right next to Isle Royale. And a lot of things that don't have the national park title, Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore, Pictured Rocks National Lakeshore, Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore, just to mention the ones on around Lake Michigan. Those didn't receive mention, and yet those are great resources. The National Seashores didn't receive recognition, National Wild and Scenic Rivers. And so there's a lot of stories that could be told. And the story that we got was a lot of Yellowstone and Yosemite. And I think you'd see the incredible diversity of the parks and have a better sense as to what's out there and what you can see if we move beyond the Y parks, as they're called, which tend to dominate politics too.
Yeah. Well, again, just as here where we're kind of finishing up, for people who would say, you know, they want to have a park experience like this, mm-hmm. and they're here in Champaign-Urbana, and you know, going again to the Yosemite or Yellowstone or Glacier, that would be great. But if you wanted to go someplace closer, your recommendations?
Closest is Indiana Dunes. Closest national park that has that title is Mammoth Cave. You can do tours of Mammoth Cave, or on the opposite side of the Green River, there's they manage it as wild, so it's you can hike or backpack or camp in that country. You can float down the Green River. There's whitewater rafting if you like that. And another one that people don't think of as a national park is Ozark National Riverways in Missouri, around the town of Eminence. It's where two rivers come together, and it is also a national park. And there's a lot of surprisingly wild country around the rivers and the country between the rivers and above the rivers in Mark Twain National Forest. And so I'd like to throw a little recommendation to those places that people don't think of as national parks but are within, you know, 4 or 5 hour drive.
Yeah, okay. Well, very good. Well, I guess at that point we'll finish up for this hour of Focus 580 with our thanks to Bob Haar. He's professor of political science here at U of I, also director of the European Union Center. Thanks.
Great. Thank you for having me on.